the next case.
Free and capital receivable for Canada versus Foster and another. Glenn W. Thompson, Kristen R. Yuri, the panel's counsel, Breckenridge, Engle, Appalachian counsel.
You may proceed.
Please the court. My name is Glenn Thompson. I am the attorney for the appellant and plaintiff below, Radiance Capital Receivables 14 LLC. The trial below was based on admitted facts where the defendants, Foster and Wilson, signed a waiver of the statute of limitations, and but for the application Virginia Code Section 801-232, judgment would have been entered for $247,621 plus judgment interest and attorney's fees to be determined. The waiver of the benefit of the statute of limitations has been admitted by Foster and Wilson. Waivers have been defined as the intentional relinquishment of a known right with both knowledge of its existence and an intention to relinquish it. This has been cited by numerous cases in this court, recently in the Hensel Phelps construction case in 2016. The appellee's brief on page 18 concedes that this is a direct definition of a waiver. Furthermore, there was no evidence presented down below in the trial court that the defendants, Mr. Foster, Mr. Wilson, did not intentionally relinquish their known right to the benefit of the statute of limitations.
So does that mean if 232, which addresses written and unwritten promises, is an intentional promise, then the statute doesn't apply?
I don't think it's an intentional promise, because the Richmond Letter case which I saw in the brief, 130 Virginia 484.
What I'm trying to ask you is, doesn't this statement, in all of the cases, an unwritten promise not to plead the statute shall be void, and a written promise not to plead the statute shall be valid, when, doesn't that presuppose someone intentionally tried to do something, like do a waiver, but now the law is coming in saying, I know you intended to do it, but we're not going to let you do it unless these circumstances are present?
I'm not quite sure I get the question, but I understand 8.01-32 is strictly limited to promises. Waivers is never mentioned in the statute, and the remedy is promissory estoppel. And if it operates on a fraud on the promisee, then the promise will not be...
The remedy is promissory estoppel?
The very first statute...
That's shall be a stop to plead if it operates as a fraud.
Right. So you're looking at
promissory estoppel. Well, promissory estoppel is a consideration substitute under contract law.
But it's a promise to plead, not to plead statute of limitations, and then it looks at the effect on the promisee as to whether it operates on a fraud. Mm-hmm. I would look at the case of Sink versus Commonwealth, the Virginia appellate court case, which looked at the difference between waiver and estoppel. It says an element of estoppel is that the party asserting estoppel must have acted upon the conduct of the other party. However, a waiver only requires the intentional unilateral act of the party against whom the waiver is asserted. It does not require reliance by the party asserting waiver. So therefore, waiver focuses on the intent of the party against whom the waiver is asserted. Estoppel focuses on reaction of the party to the conduct of the party making the promise.
If a waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right, a promise under the plain language of that term would seem to be broader. Why doesn't this umbrella term promise, whether you knew exactly what you were waiving or not, encompass as a subset a waiver?
Richmond Leather's case stated that a waiver is completed performance. It's done. And therefore, it's not a promise for future performance. Think of all the waivers that could be waived. Waiver of a right to a jury trial. That's not a promise not to assert a right to a jury trial in the future. It's a completed performance once that waiver is taken place.
It's a promise you're not going to appeal later because you didn't get a jury trial.
Well, because you waived it. You can't. You can't. You don't have to see whether the other party promisee of a waiver acted upon that promise. No, it was a waiver. You knew what you had a right. You intentionally waived that right. It's completed performance. It's over and it's done. The guarantee in this bank loan, where they received significant consideration of a large bank loan, construction loan, had numerous waivers in it.
But think through what you're saying, Mr. Thompson. If what you're saying is right, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing
okay.
it, under this statute, the legislature said, look, if you write an agreement that says, I promise later I'll never assert the statute of limitations, you've got to go through these three prongs. But if you say, whatever, I waive it, done, we don't talk about it again, yeah, you'll waive it. It doesn't matter whether it satisfies the statute or not.
That would be my
okay, tell me why that makes sense.
Why? Because the waiver is over and done with.
I mean, pragmatically, why does it make sense? Why would anyone, what kind of statute that means that?
It's an attempt to expand the language of the statute, which is strictly promises, and the cases which have interpreted, which are strictly promises. Every one of those cases that have looked at that statute included promises for future performance, not a waiver, which is a completed performance. So, I give the best example is the Hensel Phelps construction case. The Commonwealth and its agencies are not subject to the statute of limitations. In that case, Virginia Tech, way past what would have been the statutory deadline, filed suit against the general contractor for defects that were caused by the general contractor's sub. And Justice Millett specifically looked at the contracts between the general and the sub to determine whether there was a waiver in that contract of the statute of limitations. And which would infer that a waiver of the statute of limitations would be acceptable.
So, but then that raises all the problems that the statute is trying to get at, which is stale evidence and cases coming, 25, 50, 100 years later, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And all the courts are, sometimes by judicial exposition, sometimes by statute, all the states are grappling with this problem of waivers of statute limitations and then incentivizing lenders to put that as a boilerplate term in these contracts, et cetera. So it seems like the statute is trying to get at that, and through the semantic distinction you're drawing between a waiver and a promise, it would open the door to all these problems.
Let me address that. First of all, there is no waiver of the statute of limitations for the Commonwealth. And the courts have worked their way through that. Second of all, if there is a waiver of the statute of limitations, all that does is eliminate the specific date on the calendar in which a suit must be filed. Under Rule 1:4, all equitable defenses are still available to a defendant, including the equitable defense of latches. So if there is a case where stale memories, witnesses died.
Wait a minute.
Whatever.
Latches is an equitable defense. It can't be pled against a common law prima facie case. It can only be pled.
I think when there was a unification under Rule 1:4, it says that in any cause of action, all legal and equitable defenses can be pled.
Yeah, we're applicable, but you can't plead an equitable affirmative defense to a common law claim. I mean, that's not merger. That's doing away with the distinction.
I know of cases, especially in the Federal Miller Act, mm-hmm. where the conduct of the surety or the general contractor to cause the potential claimant to go beyond the date was brought up and raised as a defense and to allow the late filing of the claim.
But that's estoppel.
It's estoppel, but it's based on equity. It wasn't based on the statute itself. And I know of, I don't have the cites with me, but other cases where the conduct of the parties causing inducement to delay, if it can be shown to be conduct and it can be shown to be unreasonable conduct, was raised as a defense. So I think if you had that bad case, then that could be raised. But this is not that case because there was nothing brought up to indicate that it wasn't a waiver, that they didn't agree that it was a waiver, that they didn't know it was a waiver, and there was nothing brought up to indicate that there was any problems with memories, records, whatever, because they admitted the debt through pleadings and requests for admissions. They admitted the debt, and they admitted the amount of the debt. So this would not be the case to illustrate that when the suit was filed just a few months later and they admitted the debt. I think it's a case where they're asking this court to expand the specific language of the statute beyond the specific language of the statute to include waivers, which the court has determined in the past is essentially different than a promise with a different remedy and a different result. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Please, the court, I'm Breck Ingalls. The trial judge correctly stated the issue in this case. He said, in Virginia, can parties contractually waive the statute of limitations? He might more properly have asked if in Virginia, can parties contractually waive the statute of limitations in the original contract or agreement? In your questions, you've already talked about the reason for the statute of limitations, and of course, they're very valid reasons, so you don't have documents lost and memories lost and perhaps people who passed on. But for the alleged waiver of the statute of limitations in this case, the complaint is time barred. So if it weren't for 801-232, we would be talking today about the policy reasons why the waiver of the statute of limitations should not be allowed. And I cited four out-of-state cases which say essentially the majority rule in cases that don't have a statute like 801-232 is that you can't waive the statute of limitations. And, of course, the policy reason there is obvious because the banks and every single promissory note would have a waiver of the statute of limitations. But we don't need to worry about the policy reasons that justify common law rule or a majority rule. We have 801-232. And 801-232 is very specific about what one can do to extend the statute of limitations. It's really not a waiver and a promise not to plead. And Judge Ellis, in the case of N. Ray Slade, lays it out very clearly in a unwritten promise. It can only be extended, promise not to plead, only can be enforced if there's been some fraud. And a written promise only if the three factors apply, including that it's being extended essentially for settlement talks, number one. Number two, that it is not beyond the length of the original statute of limitations. In this case, actually in the lower court, the appellant argued fraud. The cases weren't cited, but certainly the case of Sobel versus Herman, 1940 case of this court, makes it pretty clear that the mere failure to pay does not constitute fraud. So the second argument that's before this court by appellants is that it is, quote, completed performance, and somehow that means that 801-232 does not apply, that it's completed performance. In fact, when you see the order, the final order in this case, it's endorsed, seen and objected to as Virginia Code 801-232 applies only to promises for future performance and not to contemporaneous waivers. And the argument was essentially that all of the cases under 232 that talk about promises not to plead the statute of limitations are inapplicable because they are promises for future performance. The appellants rely on Hansel versus Thompson. Hansel versus Thompson, the decision in that case of this court was simply that the flow-down provision in the contracts between the general contractors and the subcontractors did not constitute a waiver, that it was not a sufficient, knowing, intelligent waiver to constitute a waiver. So there was never any discussion in that case about 801.232 or any other provisions related to waiver. Interestingly, the briefs that were submitted in that case, there was only one brief that even mentioned 801.232, and there was no discussion in this court's opinion whatsoever. The appellants argue that there is a difference between a waiver of the statute of limitations and a promise not to plead. Again, Judge Ellis, in the In Re Slay case, found otherwise. In that case, the agreement was, quote, she will not raise the defense of the statute of limitations in any legal proceeding that relates to the funds borrowed. And throughout the opinion, Judge Ellis referred to that as the, quote, 2008 SOL waiver. And he found that that waiver did not meet the requirements of 801.232. Now, a waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right with both knowledge of its existence and an intention to relinquish it. And that statement is set forth in Hensel versus Phelps.
Why can't the definition then include the intentional waiver of a known present right to do something later? In other words, if someone says, I waive my jury trial, I'll sign a document right now, I waive my jury trial. There's no jury trial, there's no jury being impaneled at the second it's being waived. It's obviously, when I show up at trial 3 months from now, I'm not going to ask for a jury. And I'm not going to complain later to an appellate court I didn't get one. So my struggle with the semantic argument is, where is it? What is it?
Well, I think I'm answering your question when I say it's future performance. It's saying, in the future, I'm not going to assert my right. And here's the point.
So there's really no distinction between the concept of promising future performance or future inaction and waiving a known right, because you're talking about the right to do something in the future or the right to not do something in the future, right?
That's our point, exactly. When they talk about completed performance, there is no completed performance. The truth of the matter is, as to this, quote, waiver, until there is a default, which is in the future, until there is suit filed, which is in the future, and unless that suit is filed outside of the period of the statute of limitations, then there is no opportunity to invoke the statute of limitations. So it essentially, what is characterized as a waiver is that promise not to plead the statute of limitations in those circumstances in the future. And that's exactly what 801.232 gets to. So our position is respectfully that the trial court had it right, that the statute applied, that appellant did not prove fraud, did not put on any evidence as to fraud, there wasn't any testimony, and that the ruling of the trial court should be affirmed. Unless there are any questions, I will conclude.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
What counsel has not addressed is the legal impossibility that is created by the Slady decision and the prior decision, whereas interpreting that the statute 8.01-32A and the fraud exception, where all waivers or promises, either one, concerning the statute of limitations are invalid and void as a matter of law if they are made as part of the original contract, unless there is fraud And it has to be present fraud at the time that that waiver is made. Now think about that. Fraud, one of the elements of fraud is justifiable reliance. So how can one be fraudulently induced to rely on a promise not to waive the statute of limitations if they're invalid as a matter of law when they're made as part of a contract?
But isn't in subsection A the fraud there simply promissory fraud? You're saying, I'm going to make a promise, but I know right now, not in the future, I know right now I'm lying to you. I'm not going to do it, and under no circumstance I'm going to do it. That's the fraud that I think A is speaking of, right?
Okay, but if you look at the Slaney opinion, and the Solo versus Herman opinion, if that fraud is there, intentional misrepresentation, I don't intend to abide by that, how can the promise C justifiably rely
on
that promise?
But justified reliance is in order to get a monetary reward.
Well, in order for finding fraud, how can there be fraud on the promise C if there's no right if the promise C has no justifiable right under
the
law?
Sorry, I think I get it. Well, fraud is you lied,
right?
You intended to lie. Causation is reliance. That's just the but-for causation. And damages. So if you want damage.
There's a fourth element, justifiable reliance.
Okay,
the reliance has to be justifiable under the law.
Okay, fair.
You look at the Metrocall case.
Well, hold up
and
a second. So you've got the duty not to lie. You've got causation, but-for, and proximate, which is justifiable reliance. And you got damages. So the cases that say you need all three to get a monetary award, right, roger that. This statute just says, look, if there's a fraud, if you lie about it right on the spot, you have no intention of doing it, and that can be proved, that operates as a fraud. So
I question then, how does that act as a fraud on the promisee when the promisee had no right to rely? That's the word in the statute, a fraud on the promisee. How can that be a fraud on the promisee? Not that they committed fraud, but how was it a fraud on that particular promisee when the promisee had no right to rely on that promise?
Okay, so you can't get damages. I get that.
No, you can't enforce it.
Except for the statute says you
can't enforce it unless it acts as fraud on the promisee. If there's no justifiable reliance by the promisee, there's no fraud on the promisee, thus the promisee cannot enforce the waiver of the promise.
Are you saying that there conceptually could not be justifiable reliance?
Because under the statute, if it is made, if the promise or the waiver, if the court's going to equate make no distinction between waiver and promises, if it occurs as part of the original contract, under 8.01232, it's void. So how can you...
I would think it might deal with the circumstance where you have this document before you and you're negotiating with the other side and they say, Glenn, don't worry about it. I'm not going to assert the statute of limitations. And then they do when you file the lawsuits. And then you can say, no, it's detrimental reliance. I relied on you.
That's not what those two cases say. Those two cases look at the present intent of the promisor at the time the promise is made. So you get the absurd result where the promise by an honest person is unenforceable, but the promise by the dishonest person is enforceable. And I'm out of my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All the next case.